Part 6. The Trikaya Doctrine. Seemingly inexhaustible though the topics relating to Buddhism undoubtedly are, they may all be distributed under three heads: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Triratna, or three jewels, in fact constitute Buddhism. To accept Buddhism means, in traditional terminology, to go for refuge to the Enlightened One, to go for refuge to his teaching, and to go for refuge to his order. The developments which took place in the Mahayana may therefore also be classified under these headings. We shall accordingly discuss, in very general terms, firstly, the distinctively Mahayana doctrines concerning the Buddha, secondly, those pertaining to the Dharma, and thirdly, those relating to the Sangha. In the Hinayana, the Buddha was generally regarded as a human being who, after passing through the normal experiences of life, had, by means of his own exertions, attained enlightenment. The Mahayanists, however, as they penetrated deeper into the transcendental reality behind the mundane appearance, gradually evolved the doctrine of the Trikaya, the three bodies or personalities of the Buddha: the Nimanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya. According to this doctrine, the Buddha is not merely a human being, but reality itself. This reality, being not only wisdom but compassion, for the purpose of preaching the Dharma to all beings, assumes innumerable forms. These forms, of which Gautama Buddha is the one best known to us, are all identical with reality, and hence themselves wholly transcendental. Human birth and death are nothing but appearances. In reality, the Buddha is never born and never dies. He never attains enlightenment, for he is eternally enlightened. And in any case, according to the profoundest Mahayana teaching, enlightenment is in the ultimate sense unattainable. His attainment under the Bodhi tree at Gaya was, like all the other events of his earthly career, simply a skillful device, upaya kausalya, for the encouragement of the ignorant. The historical personality of the Buddha is the particular mode in which unenlightened gods and men perceive the transcendental compassionate activity of the Absolute. Presented in this bald fashion, the Mahayana conception of the Buddha nature seems at first sight to be more of the nature of a revolution than an evolution, more a radical departure than a natural development. But a number of intermediate stages do connect the Hinayana with the Mahayana conception, and perhaps the best method of comprehending the Trikaya doctrine in its fully developed form would be to trace these earlier stages of its evolution. For the sake of convenient exposition, they may be regarded as four in number. We may describe them as the early and late Hinayana and early and late Mahayana stages, respectively. The first stage is represented by the Theravada, the second by the Savastivada, the third by the Majjhimika and Mahasamgika jointly, and the fourth by the Yogacara. Each of these schools, while taking its stand upon the teaching of its predecessors, added its own contribution to the development of the doctrine. One, the early Hinayana. A great deal of discussion revolved around the question of the exact meaning of the terms Rupakaya and Dharmakaya. Though from the very beginning it was agreed that the Buddha possessed these two bodies, there was no unanimity of opinion regarding their nature and function. The early Hinayanists, for instance, conceived Buddha's Rupakaya as that of a human being, and his Dharmakaya as the collection of his dharmas, i.e. doctrines and disciplinary rules collectively. This is, generally speaking, the conception most often accounted in the Nikayas of the Theravada Pali Canon. But, as the authority just cited points out, even in these works passages do occur which admit to a different interpretation. To the monk Vakali, who on his deathbed had ardently desired to see the Buddha in person, the Blessed One said, "He who sees the Dharma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dharma. Whether we interpret these words realistically or metaphysically will depend upon the nature of the general attitude we adopt towards Buddhism. If our attitude is literal, in the sense already defined, the word Dharma, which is a key word of the whole passage, will be interpreted literally. The Dharma will be identified with its conceptual and verbal formulations. And the Buddha's admonition to Vakali will mean no more than that inasmuch as he is, metaphorically speaking, the embodiment of his various doctrines and disciplinary precepts, one who walks in accordance with them may be said to see him. If, on the other hand, our attitude is liberal, and if for us the Dharma means not so much the words and concepts which indicate reality, but reality itself, then we shall see in the utterance of the Buddha a declaration of his essential identity with the Absolute, so that to realize the Dharma and to see the Buddha are not metaphorically but in actual fact the same thing, being simply alternative ways of expressing the ultimate transcendental experience. So, two, the later Hinayana conception of the Buddha nature, while continuing to adhere to the realistic interpretation of the Rupakaya, started interpreting the Dharmakaya metaphysically. In the Abhidharma Kosha of Vasubandhu, the great Savastivadin doctor, two explanations of the Dharmakaya are given. According to the first one, the Dharmakaya is the sum total of the qualities, dharmas, constituting a Buddha, or, what comes to the same thing, the aggregate of those qualities, the acquisition of which is synonymous with the attainment of full enlightenment. Taking the first of the three refuges means taking refuge not in the Buddha in the sense of a transient human personality, but in Buddhahood. Vasubandhu has in fact demonstrated that the very act of taking refuge in the Buddha implies a non-realistic interpretation of the Dharmakaya. Gautama Buddha is dead and gone. In what, then, shall we take refuge, if not in the indestructible essence of Buddhahood? This means a metaphysical interpretation of the Buddha nature. According to Vasubandhu's second explanation, which goes a step further than his first, the Dharmakaya consists of a series of pure dharmas, or rather, a renewal of the psychophysical organism of the substratum, anasrava dhammasamatana asraya paravritti. The Dharmakaya then signifies a new purified personality or substratum, asraya. But it is pointed out that such a Dharmakaya is possessed also by an arhat. The reader probably finds these technicalities rather obscure. What Vasubandhu means can perhaps be reduced to simpler, if less precise, language. The so-called individual is nothing but a succession or stream of material and mental events or dharmas. In the case of a worldly being, contaminated as he is by greed, hatred, and delusion, these dharmas are said to be impure. In the case of a Buddha or an Arhat, these impure dharmas have all been purified by wisdom. The personality of an enlightened being is a succession or stream of pure dharmas. These pure dharmas are collectively termed the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is the same for all Buddhas. Harivarman, the founder of the Sacchasiddhi school, going a little further than Vasubandhu, differentiates the Dharmakaya of a Buddha from that of an Arhat by making it consist not only in the qualities constituting enlightenment, but also in the qualities and endowments associated with the specific cosmic functions of a Buddha as rediscoverer and re-proclaimer of the way. So three, the early Mahayana stage was mainly one of synthesis. The Prajnaparamita literature had already familiarized the Mahayana schools with a purely metaphysical interpretation of nirvana, the goal of the Buddhist life, as the state or principle of shunyata or voidness. Prajna, or wisdom, was not simply an intuitive understanding of the true nature of phenomena, but a transcendental faculty for the apprehension of that reality, shunyata, which all phenomena are, in essence. The Majjhimikas revise the Dharmakaya doctrine in the light of these conceptions. According to them, the Dharmakaya of the Buddha consists chiefly of prajna. In other words, his personality is ultimately identical with the cognition of reality. Or, since on the transcendental plane no distinction can be made between the subject and the object of knowledge, identical with reality itself. The metaphysical implications of the Buddha's declaration, "He who sees me sees the Dharma," have now been rendered fully explicit. No further development could therefore take place in this direction. So in the early Mahayana stage, we find the centre of interest shifts from the Dharmakaya of the Buddha to his Rupakaya. Discussions concerning the nature of the Rupakaya were already rife in Hinayana circles. The Theravadins and Savastivadins had argued that the material body of the Tathagata was really material and not a transcendental entity, as the Mahasanghikas in general, and as their branch, the Lokottaravadins in particular, believed. According to the more realistic view, which was the view of the Majjhimikas also, the Buddha's physical body was the product of his karma in previous existences and before its birth, which took place in the natural manner, had gone through all the normal stages of intrauterine development. These views scandalized the Mahasamgikas, who maintained the contradictory thesis that the Shakyamuni's body was an apparitional body, which, after residing in the womb for a time, 1 month in excess of the normal period of gestation, spontaneously made its appearance at the moment of parturition. They conceived Buddha, says Dr. N. Dutt, summarizing the views of the Mahasamgikas and their followers, as Lokottara, transcendental, and Shakyamuni as only a phantom, Nirmanakaya. The transcendental Buddha has a Rupakaya, which is limitless, everlasting, free from all sasrava, dharmas, impure dharmas. He is always in samadhi, never sleeps or dreams, and can know everything in an instant of thought. He knows neither fatigue nor rest and is ever busy in enlightening sentient beings. His power and his life are limitless. For the benefit of sentient beings, he appears at will in any one of the six gatis or realms. Whatever he utters relates to the truth, though people may understand him differently. In short, the Mahasamgikas conceived Buddha as a totally supermundane being, with illimitable powers and knowledge, who never desired to attain nirvana. Though this uncompromisingly transcendental conception of the Buddha nature was incorporated into the Trikaya doctrine only during the third, or what we have termed the early Mahayana stage of its development, it dates from a much earlier period of Buddhist history. As we saw at the conclusion of chapter 1, the schism between the Theravadins and the Mahasamgikas occurred about a century after the Buddha's Parinirvana, and there is sufficient literary evidence to show that by the time of Ashoka, the Lokottaravadin conception of the Buddha nature was fully developed. Indeed, it would seem that their transcendentalist doctrines were not altogether innovations upon the original teaching, but rather a systematic arrangement and an emphatic statement of traditions which had existed from the earliest times. Traces of these traditions are to be found even in the Nikayas of the Theravada Pali Canon, and signs of a slight tendency towards a non-realistic conception of the Rupakaya are by no means absent either from later Hinayana literature or from popular Hinayana belief, even at the present day. According to the Mahaparinirvana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha could, had he so wished, have remained in the world until the end of the Kalpa or world period. His Rupakaya, even if not everlasting, as the Lokottaravadins claimed, must therefore have been of immense duration. Many of the numerous passages of the Pali Canon dealing with meditation refer to the power within the reach of all who succeed in attaining the fourth jhana, of producing a subtle body resembling the gross one in every particular, except that whereas the former is made of matter, the latter is made of mind, manomaya. The Samyutta Nikaya records a dialogue on the subject between the Buddha and Ananda. Does the Exalted One fully know, Lord, how to reach the Brahma world by magic power, by means of the mind-created body? I do indeed know, Ananda. Does the Exalted One fully know, Lord, how to reach the Brahma world by means of this body, which is compounded of the four great elements? I do indeed, Ananda. A strange thing it is, Lord, a marvel it is, Lord, that the Exalted One has this knowledge. Yes, Ananda, strange indeed are the Tathagatas and endowed with strange powers. Marvellous indeed are the Tathagatas, and endowed with marvellous powers. Whenever, Ananda, the Tathagata concentrates body in mind, and concentrates mind in body, and entering on awareness of ease and buoyancy, abides therein, at such time, Ananda, the body of the Tathagata is more buoyant, softer, more pliable, and more radiant. Suppose, Ananda, a ball of iron is heated all day long. It becomes lighter, softer, more pliable, and more radiant. Just so it is, Ananda, with the body of the Tathagata. Now, Ananda, at the time when the Tathagata so concentrates body in mind and concentrates mind in body, the Tathagata's body, with but little effort, rises from the earth into the sky, and in divers ways enjoys magic power, to wit, being one he becomes many, and so forth, and he has power over the body even up to the world of Brahma. Just as, Ananda, a ball of cotton or thistledown, light and borne by the wind with but little effort, rises from the ground into the sky, just so when the Tathagata concentrates mind in body and body in mind, does he in divers ways enjoy magic power, even up to the world of Brahma. That's from the Samyutta Nikaya, verse 283-4, Woodward's translation. According to Buddhaghosa, once, when the Buddha was engaged in preaching the Abhidharma to his mother in the Tushita heaven, he created a number of Nimitta Buddhas to take his place on earth. All these mind-formed Buddhas were in speech, appearance and behaviour his exact replicas, down even to the rays of light issuing from their bodies. And the difference between them and the Buddha's original body could be detected only by gods belonging to the higher ranks of the celestial hierarchy. With regard to the mode of the Shakyamuni's birth, the Digha Nikaya says that an ordinary being enters the womb unconscious, so remains and so comes forth. The 80 great disciples enter the womb fully conscious, but remain in it and come forth from it unconscious of the past. The two chief disciples, in this case Sariputra and Moggallana, enter the womb fully conscious and so remain, but coming forth they lose recollection. The Buddha, however, in his last birth, enters the womb, remains in it, and comes forth from it with perfect recollection of his past career and fully conscious of his future greatness. Even according to Hinayana tradition, the Buddha's appearance in the world by no means took place in the normal manner. He issued from the right side of his mother without pain and with a great multitude of celestial beings in attendance. Says the poet Ashvaghosha, whose great poem, the Buddha Charita, is from the doctrinal point of view, probably a Savastivada work. At the time of the constellation, Pushya was auspicious, and from the side of the queen, he was purified by her vow. Her son was born for the welfare of the world, without pain and without illness. The words purified by her vow probably refer to the tradition handed down by both Hinayana and Mahayana schools, that the conception of the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, took place at a time when his mother, Mahamaya, was observing the 8 precepts. Since the 3rd precept enjoins complete celibacy, the Bodhisattva's conception obviously could not have taken place as the result of sexual intercourse. His body, therefore, not being the product of ovum and spermatozoan, could not have been material. It must have been non-material. The non-realistic theses of the Lokottaravada were little more than a collation of common traditions of this kind. So far as we can judge from the existing literary remains, one such thesis alone seems not to have been directly implied by the original teaching. This was the Lokottaravadin's definite insistence that what appeared to be the physical body of the Buddha was in reality not mundane but transcendental. True, the Pali texts speak of a manomayakaya, or mind-formed body, but the mind of an enlightened person, no less than his physical body, is mundane. A transcendental body can be the property only of one who has realized the transcendental. Since, according to the Hinayana teaching, the Shakyamuni did not attain enlightenment until he was 35 years of age, he could not have attained a transcendental body until that time. Consequently, even though he might have been born with a mind-made body, he could not have been born with one that was transcendental. The Lokottaravadins, however, maintained that the body of the Tathagata was transcendental from the time of his apparent birth to the time of his apparent death. For was not the transcendental Rupakaya possessed of endless life and infinite power? In order to safeguard the transcendental nature of the Buddha's Rupakaya, the Lokottaravadins were, logically speaking, compelled to regard the Buddha's enlightenment as having taken place long before his present birth. We have no means of ascertaining whether such a conclusion was actually drawn at this stage, but during the later Mahayana stage, it was certainly drawn by the Yogacharins and constitutes one of the most important elements in the fully developed Trikaya doctrine. This process of antedating the Buddha's enlightenment may have been facilitated by the development of the Bodhisattva doctrine, which, as a description of the career of Gautama the Buddha in his previous existences, was accepted even by the Theravada. Dhyana, or Samadhi, is, according to the Mahayanists, the 5th of the 6 or 10 paramitas which the Bodhisattva must practice in order to prepare himself for the attainment of Buddhahood. Though not enumerated in the corresponding Hinayana lists, its practice is implied by the inclusion of metta and upekkha, both of which are forms of meditation, as well as by the inclusion of panna, or wisdom, for the attainment of which the practice of jhana is indispensable. As we have already seen, the creation of a mind-form body is within the reach of anyone attaining the 4th stage of superconsciousness. The Bodhisattva, having in the course of his previous existences perfected himself in meditation, must be possessed of a mind-form body, by means of which it will be possible for him to appear first in the Tusita heaven and then on earth, wherein, as an actor on the stage, he would enact the drama of birth, enlightenment and parinirvana. This mind-formed body could, however, be regarded as being of a transcendental nature, as the Lokottaravadins claimed, only if the Bodhisattva could be shown to have attained nirvana, in the Hinayana sense of the term, at some time during the course of his previous career. This had to be demonstrated by the Yogacharins and others at the 4th and last stage in the development of the Trikaya doctrine. Meanwhile, the achievement of the 3rd stage may be held to consist in its synthesis of the Majjhimika conception of the Dharmakaya with a Lokottaravadin conception of the Rupakaya, which, by a significant adjustment of terms, became known as the Nimanakaya, or body of transformation. 4. If the early Mahayana stage was chiefly one of synthesis, the late Mahayana stage was mainly one of elaboration. Having clearly demonstrated the purely transcendental nature of the Rupakaya, or Nimanakaya, The Mahayanists proceeded to distinguish the gross Rupakaya form from its subtle counterpart. This subtle Rupakaya was then subjected to a further process of subdivision. These two developments, with which the Trikaya doctrine was brought to perfection, were both largely the achievement of the Yogacharins. We shall deal with each of them in turn. As already indicated, without antedating the Buddha's attainment of Nirvana from his present life to one of his past lives, it is impossible to establish the purely transcendental nature of his Rupakaya. That the Yogacharins were able to surmount this formidable obstacle was due to the developments which had taken place in Mahayana philosophy as a whole, particularly to the sharp distinction which came to be drawn between the Hinayana and Mahayana conceptions of Nirvana, and the more detailed and dogmatic treatment given to the various stages, bhumis, of the Bodhisattva's career. Since the Mahayana ideal was not spiritual individualism, but transcendental altruism, it naturally tended to relegate all merely individual gains to a comparatively inferior position in the hierarchy of spiritual attainments. Thus, though not denying the possibility of an individual nirvana being gained by Sravakas and Pratyekya Buddhas, if they so wished, they refused either to consider such a state as identical with reality or to regard its attainment as the ultimate objective of the Bodhisattva's career. This career consists of 10 successive stages or bhumis. According to the Dasabhumika Sutra, in which the fullest and most systematic treatment of the doctrine of bhumis is found, it is at the 8th bhumi, namely Achala, or the immovable, that the Bodhisattva definitely renounces the prospect of individual nirvana, which is at this stage within his reach, and instead perseveres in his efforts to attain full enlightenment for the good of all sentient beings. We must beware, however, of understanding our conceptual formulations of these exalted experiences too literally. Though, at the 8th stage of his career, the Bodhisattva does not attain nirvana in the sense in which it is attained by the Sravakas and the Pratyekya Buddhas, it must not be supposed, therefore, that he does not attain nirvana in any sense. He attains whatever they attain, but with this difference, that whereas they, because they cherished an individualistic spiritual ideal, from the moment of their attaining nirvana, cease to exist so far as the phenomenal world is concerned, he, being supported by the sustaining power of the Buddhas, and by his own age-old vow to lead all sentient beings to enlightenment, simultaneously attained a transcendental body by means of which he continues to appear in the various realms of phenomenal existence. This doctrine is clearly enunciated in the Lankavatara Sutra, wherein the Lord, discoursing to Mahamati on the 10 stages of the Bodhisattvahood, says, "Further, Mahamati, the Sravakas and Pratyekya Buddhas at the 8th stage of Bodhisattvahood are so intoxicated with the happiness that comes from the attainment of perfect tranquilization, and failing to understand fully that there is nothing in the world but what is seen of the mind itself, they are thus unable to overcome the hindrances and habit energy growing out of their notions of generality and individuality, and adhering to the egolessness of persons and things and cherishing views arising therefrom, they have the discriminating idea and knowledge of nirvana, which is not that of the truth of absolute solitude. Mahamati, when the Bodhisattvas face and perceive the happiness of the samadhi of perfect tranquilization, they are moved with the feeling of love and sympathy, owing to their original vows, and they become aware of the part they are to perform as regards the 10 inexhaustible vows. Thus they do not enter nirvana. But the fact is that they are already in nirvana, because in them there is no rising of discrimination. The obtainment of the Nirmanakaya at this stage is clearly indicated by the text in the following verse. When those who are born of the Buddha see that the world is no more than mind itself, they will obtain a body of transformation which has nothing to do with effect-producing works, but which is endowed with the powers, psychic faculties, and self-control. As Eliot, summarising the Trikaya doctrine, tersely puts the matter, according to the general opinion of the Mahayanists, a Buddha attains to nirvana by the very act of becoming a Buddha, and is therefore beyond everything which we call existence. Yet the compassion which he feels for mankind, and the good karma which he has accumulated, cause a human image of him, nirmanakaya, to appear among men for their instruction, and a superhuman image, perceptible yet not material, to appear in paradise. Becoming a Buddha and obtaining nirvana, in the Hinayana sense, however, occurs, according to the Mahayanists, in the eighth stage of the Bodhisattva's career. Hence does Har Dayal, in his account of this stage, as described in the Dasabhumika Sutra, declare, "This bhumi is so important that it is called the stage of perfection, of birth, of finality. Thereafter, the Bodhisattva lives and works in a transcendental body, and it is apparently in such a body that, having obtained the Dharmakaya in the tenth stage of his career, he appears on earth as a perfect Buddha. According to the Dasabhumika, upon the attainment of the Dharmakaya, the Bodhisattva attains a glorious body, seated on a celestial lotus adorned with jewels. The nature of the relation between this body and the body or bodies attained in the eighth stage does not seem to have been made the subject of investigation. Relating as it does to experiences beyond the power of heart to conceive or tongue to utter, the matter is abstruse in the extreme. But it can at least be safely asserted that if the nirvana attained in the eighth stage is transcendental, the body then acquired must be transcendental too. At any rate, the Bodhisattva's career, being thought of as infinitely long, and ages incalculable, being considered to elapse from the attainment of one stage to the attainment of the next, there was a tendency on the part of the Mahayanists to think of the acquisition of the transcendental body as having taken place at an age infinitely remote from the present. Hence the great bodhisattvas such as Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri have no history. Practically speaking, they are purely transcendental personages, bright effluences of the bright essence uncreate of the Absolute, eternally existent outpourings of the compassion which is wisdom and the wisdom which is compassion, the everlasting saviours of mankind. The doctrine of bhumis, having enabled the Mahayanists to antedate the Buddha's attainment of nirvana, thus establishing the transcendental nature of his rupakaya, all that they had to do in order to bring the Trikaya doctrine to perfection was to subdivide the rupakaya into a gross and a subtle form. This development, the last of the long series, was again the work of the Yogacharins, who proceeded to distinguish between the personalities styled, when at a later period the terminology of the doctrine became more fixed, as Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya. The basis of this distinction is the idea that a Buddha or a Bodhisattva appears to different beings in different ways, according to their various tastes and temperaments, and their various degrees of spiritual refinement. Indeed, it is not so much that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas assume different forms, as that the same transcendental compassionate activity of the Absolute is perceived in different ways by different minds, being thereby, as it were, broken up into a multitude of glorious figures, in much the same way as a beam of light, on passing through a prism, is broken up into all the glowing iridescent hues of the rainbow. Carried to its logical conclusion, this would mean that there are as many Buddhas or Bodhisattvas as there are sentient creatures in the universe, each divine form being the mode under which the Dharmakaya exists for and through which it acts upon one particular person, or even one particular thing. From these premises, the Lankavatara arrives at the conclusion that just as the hand may be called Hasta or Kara or Pani, and the body Tanu or Deha or Sarira, so may the Tathagata come within the range of hearing of ignorant people in this world of patience, under many names, amounting to 100,000 times 3 asamkheyas, by which they address him, not knowing that they are names of the Tathagata. Indeed, it roundly declares that even the names of various non-Buddhist deities, such as Brahma and Vishnu, as well as the numerous Buddhist and non-Buddhist designations of reality, such as Nirvana, the Eternal, the Emptiness, the Dhammadhatu, the Formless, are all appellations of the Tathagata. This dangerous doctrine, which ultimately helped to sap the foundations of Buddhism in India, did not all at once make its appearance. Since it was possible to divide sentient beings into two classes, the spiritually developed and the spiritually undeveloped, the primary division of the Rupakaya was, as we have seen, into the Sambhogakaya, or body of enjoyment, which is the Dharmakaya as perceived in the celestial realms by bodhisattvas coursing in any one of the ten bhumis, and the Nimanakaya, which is the same reality as perceived on earth by Sravakas, Pratyekya Buddhas and ordinary folks, as well as by those bodhisattvas who have not yet entered on the first bhumi. The Sambhogakaya again is twofold, consisting of the Svavambhoga, or form in which a Buddha is perceived by the Buddhas of the other world systems, and the Parasambhoga, or form perceived by bodhisattvas. This refinement of analysis possesses, however, only a theoretical interest, and for all practical purposes, the Buddha is regarded as possessing simply three bodies, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nimanakaya. The nature of the first and last of these having been explained when we dealt with the second and third stages in the development of the Trikaya doctrine, the second one alone, that is to say the Sambhogakaya, now claims our attention. Just as the Nimanakaya, in the sense of the human and historical Shakyamuni, is the central figure of the Hinayana, so is the Sambhogakaya, in one or another of its numerous resplendent manifestations, the dominating figure of the Mahayana. It is the Sambhogakaya which preaches the Mahayana sutras, just as it is the Nimanakaya which preaches those of the Hinayana. He is the supreme object of faith and devotion, the ultimate dazzling focus into which are concentrated, like innumerable converging beams of light, all those incipient strivings and yearnings of the heart, those half-blind impulses to perfection, those mighty soaring flights of love and adoration, which in less philosophical religions are directed towards more or less crude conceptions of the theistic order. His glorious body, adorned with the 32 major and 80 minor marks of a Buddha, the illimitable radiance of which fills the entire cosmos, has ever been a favourite subject of Mahayana art, and the various transcendental forms in which it dawns sun-like above the horizon of the devotee's meditation have in the course of time been embodied in works of art, which apart from their value of supports of the spiritual life in general and the practice of meditation in particular, are acclaimed as being among the greatest artistic treasures of mankind. So fervent was the devotion of the Mahayanists, so exuberantly creative their spiritual imagination, and so intensive their artistic activity, that the spacious Mahayana heaven speedily became populated with a glorious company of transcendental beings, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and a host of lesser divinities, every one of whom possessed his or her distinctive attributes and individual personality. So numerous indeed did these Sambhogakaya forms eventually become that the Mahayanists began to feel the need for reducing them to some kind of order. Different systems of classification were accordingly adopted by different schools, the best known and most popular being a grouping into five families, over each of which a particular Buddha presided. These five families were correlated with the five elements, the five skandhas, the five senses, and so on, as well as with various colours, letters of the alphabet, points of the compass, animals, etc. Varochana, Amitabha, Ratnasambhava, Amoghasiddhi, and Akshobhya are the five presiding Buddhas of this system, their families consisting of the great bodhisattvas, each of whom is associated with this or that Buddha as his spiritual son, as well as of the female consorts, which at a later stage of development each Buddha and bodhisattva was considered to possess. Buddha Amitabha, for instance, presides over the lotus family. His colour is red, his direction the west, his paradise Sakavati, the land of bliss. He is associated with the Samnyaskanda, or aggregate of perception. His consort is the goddess Pandaravasini. And the senior most of his spiritual sons, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. The daughter of Avalokiteshvara is the goddess Tara. Moreover, since every Nirmanakaya was the reflection in the muddy waters of the world of one particular Sambhogakaya, who remains the while in moon-like splendour high in the heavens of the transcendental, it was also possible to incorporate the various human, if not always historical, Buddhas into the scheme. For this reason, Shakyamuni is associated with Amitabha as that Buddha's most recent earthly manifestation. And since this is the latest manifestation of a Sambhogakaya to have taken place, the present world period is believed to be under the special protection of Amitabha and Avalokiteshvara. In the system as a whole, however, Gautama the Buddha occupies a distinctly subordinate, indeed an almost insignificant position, and one is not unoften left with the impression that the Mahayana could now get on quite well without him. As Konze says, to the Christian and agnostic historian, only the human Buddha is real, and the spiritual and magical Buddha are to him nothing but fictions. The perspective of the believer is quite different. The Buddha nature and the Buddha's glorious body stand out most clearly, and the Buddha's human body and historical existence appear like a few rags thrown over this spiritual glory. It is this spiritual glory, and not the feeble glimmerings of historical evidence, which, brought to a focus in the Trikaya doctrine, particularly in its conception of the Sambhogakaya, is the true light of the Mahayana. By its emphasis on the transcendental aspects of the Buddha nature, the Mahayana not only lifts Buddhism far above the plane of mere historicity, but also fully vindicates its eternal truth and universal significance.